Volyova smiled to herself. If Sajaki even admitted such a thing, his ascent of the mesa must have been close to torture. "They say that the Tropathas have access to Martian genetic technology," he continued, "which facilitates easier breathing, though I've seen nothing to prove this. My pipeline friends helped me find a room in a hostel used by miners from beyond the city, which, of course, fitted in perfectly with my cover story. I wouldn't describe the accommodation as salubrious, but it suited my purpose well enough, which was, of course, to gather data. In the course of my inquiries," Sujaki added, "I learnt much that was contradictory, or at best vague." Sajaki had now turned almost from horizon to horizon. The sun was now beyond his right shoulder, making his image increasingly difficult to interpret. The ship, of course, would simply switch to infrared, reading Sajaki's speech in the shifting blood patterns of his face. "Eyewitnesses say Sylvester and his wife managed to escape the assassination attempt which killed Girardio, but they have not resurfaced since. That was 8 months ago. The people I have spoken to, and the covert data sources I have intercepted, lead me to one conclusion. Sylvester is someone's prisoner again, except this time he is being held outside the city, probably by one of the True Path cells." Volyova was tense now. She could see where all this was leading. There had always been a kind of inevitability to it. The only difference was that in this case it stemmed from what she knew about Sajaki, rather than the man he sought. "It would be futile to negotiate with the official powers here, whoever they are," Sajaki said. "I doubt that they could give us Sylvester even if they wanted to hand him over, which of course they wouldn't, which unfortunately leaves us only one option." Volyova bridled. Here it was. "We must arrange things so that it is in the best interests of the colony as a whole to give us Sylvester." Sajaki smiled again, teeth flashing against the shadow of his face. "Needless to say, I have already been laying the necessary groundwork." And now he really was addressing her directly, no doubt about it. "Volyova, you may make the necessary formal overtures at your discretion." Ordinarily she might have felt some consolatory pleasure at having judged Sajaki's intention so accurately. Not now. All she felt was a slow-burning horror, the realization that, after all this time, he was going to ask her to do it again. And the worst component of her horror stemmed from the realization that she would probably do what he wanted.
"Go on," Volyova said. "It won't bite.
I do know suits, Triumvir." Kuri paused and took a step into the room's whiteness. "It's just I didn't think I'd see one again, let alone get to actually wear the bastard." The four waiting suits rested against the wall in the oppressively white storage room, 600 levels below the bridge, adjacent to Chamber 2, where the training session would take place.
"Listen to her,"
one of the two other women present said, "talking as if she's going to do more than just wear the damn thing for a few minutes. It's not like you're going down with us, Kuri, so don't wet yourself." "Thanks for the advice, Sujik. I'll bear it in mind." Sujik shrugged. A sneer would have been too much of an emotional expenditure, Kuri figured, and stepped towards her designated suit, followed by her companion, Sula Kjarval. Preparing to welcome their occupants, the suits resembled frogs which had been exsanguinated, eviscerated, dissected, stretched, and pinned out on a vertical table. In their current configurations, the suits were at their most androform, with well-defined legs and outstretched arms. There were no fingers on the hands, for that matter no obvious hands at all, simply streamlined flippers, although at the user's wish the suits could extrude the necessary manipulators and digits. Kuri did indeed know suits, just as she had claimed. The suits on Sky's Edge had been rare imports, purchased from ultra-traders who made stopovers around the war-torn planet. No one on the Edge had the expertise to actually duplicate them, which meant that those units which her side had bought were fabulously valuable. Powerful totems dispensed from gods. The suit scanned her, assessing her bodily dimensions before adjusting its own interior to precisely match her contours. Kuri then allowed it to step forward and surround her, suppressing the tinge of claustrophobia that accompanied the process. Within a few seconds the suit had locked tight and filled itself with gel air, enabling maneuvers which would otherwise have crushed its occupant. The suit's persona interrogated Kuri regarding small details she might wish changed, allowing her to customize her weapons suite and adjust its autonomous routines. Of course, none but the lightest weapons would actually be deployed in Chamber 2. The combat scenarios which were to be enacted would be a seamless mixture of real, physical action and simulated weapons usage. But it was the point that counted. One had to treat every aspect of the Enterprise with the utmost seriousness, including the limitless choices which the suit offered for the convenience of dispatching any enemies who might have the misfortune to stray into its sphere of superiority. There were three of them, apart from Kuri herself, but she was the only one who was not in serious contention for the surface operation. Volyova took the lead. Although her conversations with Kuri suggested that she had been born in space, she had visited planets on more than one occasion, and had acquired the appropriate near-instinctive reflexes which bettered the chances of surviving a planetary excursion, not least among these being a profound respect for the law of gravitation. The same went for Sudyuk. She had been born in a habitat, or possibly a lighthugger, but had visited enough worlds to gain the right moves. Her blade-like thinness, which made it look as if she could not possibly have taken a footstep on a large planet without breaking every bone in her body, did not fool Kuri for a moment. Sudyuk was like a building designed by a master architect, who knew the precise stresses which had to be obeyed by every articulation and strut, and took an aesthetic pride in allowing for no additional tolerances. Kjarval, the woman who was always with Sudyuk, was different again. Unlike her friend, she exhibited no extreme chimeric traits, all her limbs her own, but she resembled no human Kuri had ever known. Her face was sleek, as if optimized for some unspecified aquatic environment. Her cat-like eyes were gridded red orbs with no pupils. Her nostrils and ears were rilled apertures, and her mouth was a largely expressionless slot, one that barely moved when the woman spoke, but was permanently curved in an expression of mild exultation. She wore no clothes, not even in the relative cool of the suit storage room, yet to Kuri's eyes she did not seem truly naked. Rather, she looked like a naked woman who had been dipped in some infinitely flexible, quick-drying polymer, a true ultra, in other words, of uncertain and almost certainly non-Darwinian provenance. Kuri had heard tales of bioengineered human splinter species cultured under the ice of worlds like Europa, or of Mer people, bio-adapted for life in totally flooded spacecraft. Sula seemed to be the living, freakishly hybrid embodiment of these myths. Alternatively, she might be something else entirely. Maybe she had wrought these transformations on herself for a whim. Maybe they were purposeless, or served only the deeper purpose of masking another identity entirely. Whatever, she knew worlds, and that, seemingly, was all that mattered. Sajaki knew worlds as well, of course, but he was already on Resurgim, and it was not clear what role he would play in the recovery of Sylvest, if and when it happened. Of Triumvir Hegazi, Kuri knew little, but through chance remarks, she had gleaned enough to know that the man had never set foot on anything which had not been manufactured. It was no wonder that Sajaki and Volyova had relegated Triumvir Hegazi to the more clerical aspects of their profession. He would not be allowed, nor did he even wish, to make the journey to Resurgim's surface when the time came. Which left Kuri. There was no arguing with her experience. Unlike any of the crew, she had demonstrably been born and raised on a planet, and, vitally, had seen action on one. It was probable, nothing she had heard led her to doubt the fact, that the Sky's Edge ward had placed her in situations far graver than any of the crew had experienced beyond their ship. Their excursions had been shopping trips, trade missions, or simple tourism, coming down to gloat at the compressed lives of ephemerals. Kuri had been in situations where, at times, it had seemed very unlikely that she would survive. Yet, because she had never been anything less than a competent soldier, and she was also lucky, she had come through relatively unscathed. No one aboard the ship actually argued with this, It's not that we wouldn't want you along, Volyova had said, not long after the incident with the cash weapon. Far from it. I've no doubt that you'd handle a suit as well as any of us, and you wouldn't be likely to freeze under fire. Well then? But I can't risk losing my gunnery officer again. They had been having the discussion in the spider room, but Volyova had lowered her voice all the same. Only 3 people need to go down to research him, and that means we don't have to use you. Apart from me, Sujik and Kjarval can handle the suits. In fact, we've already begun training up. Then at least let me join in the sessions. Volyova had raised an arm, apparently to dismiss this suggestion. But as soon as she had done so, she relented. All right, Guri, you get to train with us. But it doesn't mean anything, understand? Oh yes, she understood. Things were different between Guri and Volyova now. They had been ever since Guri had told Volyova the lie about being an infiltrator for another crew. The Mademoiselle had long ago primed her for that particular little chat, and it seemed to have worked perfectly, even down to the sly way the Galatea, completely innocent, of course, had deliberately not been mentioned, leaving Volyova to make that deduction herself, and thereby allowing her to feel some quiet satisfaction in the process. It was a red herring, but it mattered only that Volyova found it a plausible one. Volyova had also accepted the story about Sunstealer being a piece of human-designed infiltration software, and for now her curiosity seemed satisfied. Now they were almost equals, both having something to hide from the rest of the crew, even if what Volyova thought she had on Guri was not even close to the truth.
I understand, Guri said.
Still, it's a shame, though. Volyova smiled. I get the impression you always wanted to meet Sylvester. You'll get your chance, of course, once we bring him aboard.
Guri smiled.
That'll have to do then, won't it?
Chamber 2 was an empty twin of the chamber where the cash weapons were kept. Unlike the weapon-filled chamber, it had been pressurized up to 1 standard atmosphere. This was no mere extravagance. It constituted the largest single pocket of breathable air aboard the Lighthugger, and was therefore used as a reservoir for supplying normally vacuum-filled regions of the ship with air when they needed to be entered by unsuited humans. Usually the drive would have supplied an illusory 1G of gravity, acting along the long axis of the ship, which was also the long axis of the roughly cylindrical chamber. But now that the drive had been quenched, now that the ship was in orbit around Resurgam, the illusion of gravity came from rotating the whole chamber, which meant that gravity acted at 90 degrees to the long axis, pushing radially outwards from the chamber's middle. Near the middle, there was almost no gravity at all. Objects could free float there for minutes before their inevitable small initial drift slowly pushed them away from the middle. Thereafter, the increasing wind pressure of the co-rotating air would tug them faster and lower. But nothing fell in straight lines in the chamber, at least not from the point of view of someone standing on the rotating wall. They entered at one end of the cylinder, via an armored clamshell door, whose inner face was pitted with blast marks and projectile impact craters. Every visible surface of the chamber was similarly weathered. As far as Guri could see, and the suit's vision augmentation routines meant she could see as far as she wished, there was no square meter of the chamber's skin which had not been harried, scarred, gouged, buckled, assaulted, melted or corroded by some kind of weapon. It might once have been silver, now it was purple, like an all-enveloping metallic bruise. Illumination was supplied not from a stationary light source, but from dozens of free-floating drones, each of which picked out a spot on the chamber's wall with a floodlight of actinic brilliance. The drones were constantly moving around, like a swarm of agitated glowworms. The result was that no shadow in the chamber stayed still for more than a second or so, and it was impossible to look in any direction for more than a second before a blinding light source entered it, washing everything else out.
"You're sure you can handle this?" Sujuk said, as the door locked shut behind them. "You wouldn't want to damage that suit. You break it, you bought it, you know."
"Concentrate on not damaging your own," Guri said.
Then she switched to the private channel, addressing Sujik alone.
"Maybe it's just my imagination, but do I get the impression you don't like me very much?"
"Now why would you think that?"
I think it might have something to do with Nagorny. Kuri paused. It had occurred to her that the private channels might not be private at all. But then again, nothing she was about to say would not already be completely obvious to anyone listening in, most especially not to Volyova. I don't know exactly what happened with him, except that you were close. Close isn't a word for it, Kuri. Lovers, then. I wasn't going to say that in case I offended you. Don't worry about offending me, kid. It's way too late for that. Volyova's voice interrupted them. Kick off and descend to the chamber wall, you three. They obeyed her, using their suits on mild amplification to jump away from the plate which capped the end of the cylinder. They had been in freefall from the moment they entered the place, but now, as they descended towards the wall, floor, and picked up circumferential speed, their sense of weight mounted. The change was small, cushioned within the gel air, but it gave enough small cues to engender a sense of up and down. "I understand why you resent me," Kuri said.
"That you do. I took his position, filled his role. After whatever happened to him, you suddenly had me to deal with."
Kuri did her best to sound reasonable, as if she was taking none of this personally.
"If I was in your shoes, I think I'd feel the same. In fact, I'm sure of it. But that doesn't make it right, either. I'm not your enemy, Sujik."
"Don't delude yourself."
"About what?"
"That you understand one-tenth of what this is about."
Sujik had positioned her suit close to Kuri's now. Seamless white armor, stark against the damaged wall of the chamber. Kuri had seen images of ghostly white whales which lived, or used to live, she wasn't sure, in Earth's seas. Belugas, they were called, and they came to mind now.
"Listen," Sujik said, "do you think I'm simplistic enough that I'd hit you just because you filled the space Boris left?"
"Don't insult me, Kuri."
"Not my intention, believe me. If I hit you, Kuri, it's for a perfectly good reason. It's because you belong to her."
She emitted the last word as a gasp of pure animosity.
"Volyova. You're her trinket. I hate her, so naturally I hate her possessions, especially those whom she values. And of course, if I found a way to harm one of her possessions, do you imagine I wouldn't do it?"
"I'm nobody's possession," Kuri said. "Not Volyova's, not anyone's."
She immediately hated herself for protesting so vigorously, and then began to hate Sujik for pushing her to the cusp of this defensiveness.
"Not that it's any of your business. You know what, Sujik?
I'm dying to hear.
From what I heard, Boris wasn't the sanest individual who ever lived. From what I hear, Volyova didn't so much drive him mad as try and use his madness for something constructive."
She felt her suit decelerate, softly depositing her, feet first, on the crumpled wall.
"So it didn't work. Big deal. Maybe you two deserved each other."
"Yeah, maybe we did."
"What?"
"I don't necessarily like anything that you just said, Kuri. Fact is, if we didn't have company, and if we weren't suited up, I might take a few moments to teach you how easily I could break your neck. Might still do it, one of these days. But I've got to admit, you've got spite. Most of her puppets usually lose that straight away, if she doesn't fry them first. You're saying you misjudged me. Excuse me if I don't sound grateful. I'm seeing maybe you aren't as much her possession as she imagines."
Sujik laughed. "It's not a compliment, kid, just an observation. It might be worse for you once she realizes. It doesn't mean you're off my shit list, either."
Kuri might have replied, but anything she intended to say was drowned out by Volyova, who was again speaking over the general's suit channel, addressing the three of them from her vantage point high above near the chamber's middle.
"There is no structure to this exercise," she said, "at least none that you need know about. Your sole obligation is to stay alive until the scenario is over. That's all there is to it. The exercise begins in 10 seconds. I won't be available for questions during the course of it."
Kuri absorbed this without any undue worry. There had been many unstructured exercises on the edge, and many more in the gunnery. All it meant was that the deeper purpose of the scenario was masked, or that it was, literally, an exercise in disorientation, intended to represent the chaos which might follow an operation which had gone badly wrong. They began with warm-up exercises. Valyova watched them from on high, while a variety of drone targets emerged from previously concealed trapdoors in the wall of the chamber. The targets were not much of a challenge, at least not at first. At the beginning, the suits retained enough autonomy to detect and react to the targets before the wearer had even noticed them, so that all the wearer needed to do was issue consent for the kill. But it became harder. The targets stopped being passive and began to shoot back, usually indiscriminately, but with steadily mounting firepower, so that even wide shots posed a threat. The targets also got smaller and faster, popping out of the trap doors with increasing frequency, and, keeping pace with the increasing danger posed by the enemy, the suits suffered progressive losses of functionality. By the sixth or seventh round, most of the suit autonomy had been eroded, and the sensor webs which each suit draped around itself were breaking up, so that the wearers had to rely increasingly on their own visual cues. Yet though the exercise had increased in difficulty, Kuri had worked through similar scenarios so often that she did not begin to lose her cool. One had to remember how much of the suit functionality remained. One still had the weapons, the suit power, and flight capability. The three of them did not communicate during the initial exercises. They were too intent on finding their own mental edges. Eventually it was like getting a second wind, a state of stability which lay beyond what at first seemed like the limits of normal performance. Getting there was a little like entering a trance state. There were certain tricks of concentration one could call into play, rote mantras which mediated the transition. It was never just a matter of wishing it and being there. It was more like climbing onto some awkward ledge. But as one did it, and did it over again, one found that the move became more fluid, and the ledge no longer seemed quite so high or inaccessible. But it was never reached simply, or without some expenditure of mental effort. It was during the ascension to that state that Kuri half thought she had seen the Mademoiselle. It was not even a glimpse, just a peripheral awareness that, momentarily, there had been another body out there in the chamber, and that its shape might have been that of the Mademoiselle. But the sensation vanished as quickly as it had come. Could it have been her? Kuri had not seen or heard from the Mademoiselle since the incident in the gunnery room. The Mademoiselle's last communique to her had been more pique than anything else, delivered after Kuri had helped Valyova finish off the cash weapon. She had warned her that by remaining in the gunnery so long, she had brought Sunstealer on herself. And, indeed, the moment that Kuri tried to leave gunspace, she had felt something rushing towards her. It had come at her like a largening shadow, but she had not felt anything when the shadow seemed to engulf her. It was as if a hole had opened in the shadow, and she had passed unscathed through it, but she doubted that that had really been the case. The truth was almost certainly less palatable. Kuri did not want to consider the possibility that the shadow might have been Sunstealer, but it was a conclusion she could not ignore. And in accepting that, she also had to accept the likelihood that Sunstealer had now managed to ensconce a much larger part of himself in her skull. It had been bad enough knowing that a small part of that thing had come back with the Mademoiselle's bloodhounds, but that at least had been contained. It had been within the Mademoiselle's powers to hold him at bay. Now Kuri had to accept that a more substantial fragment of Sunstealer had reached her, and the Mademoiselle had been curiously absent ever since, until this voiceless half-glimpse, which might have been nothing at all, less than a figment of her imagination, something which any sane person would have dismissed as a trick of the light at the edge of vision. If it had been her, what did it mean after all this time? Eventually, the initial phase of exercises finished, and some of the suit functionality was reinstated. Not everything, but enough to let the three of them know that a certain slate had been wiped clean, and that from now the rules would be different. "All right," Valyova said. "I've seen the worse." "I'd take that as a compliment," Kuri said, hoping to elicit some vague camaraderie from her compatriots. "But the trouble with Ilya is she means it literally." "At least one of you gets it," Valyova said. "But don't let it go to your head, Kuri, especially as it's about to get serious." At the far end of the chamber, another clamshell door was easing open. Because of the constantly shifting light, Kuri saw what happened more as a series of frozen, glare-saturated images than actual motion. Things were spilling out, an expanding mass of ellipsoidal objects, each perhaps half a meter long, metallic white in color, with various protrusions, gun nozzles, manipulators and apertures interrupting its surface. Sentry drones. She knew them, or something similar, from the Edge. They had called them wolfhounds, because of the ferocity of their attack, and the fact they always moved in packs. Although their main military use was as an instrument of demoralization, Kuri knew what they could do, and she knew that wearing a suit was no guarantee of safety. Wolfhounds were built for viciousness, not intelligence. They carried relatively light weapons, but they did so in large numbers, and more to the point, they acted in unison. A pack of wolfhounds could collectively target their fire against a single individual, if their pooled processors deemed that the action was strategically useful. It was that single-mindedness which made them terrifying. But there was more. Embedded in the mass of erupting drones were several larger objects, also metallic white in color, but lacking the spherical symmetry of the wolfhounds. It was difficult to make them out clearly in the intermittent bursts of illumination. But Kuri thought she knew what they were. They were other suits, and they were very unlikely to be friendly. The wolfhounds and the enemy suits were dropping away from the central axis now, vectoring towards the three waiting trainees. Perhaps 2 seconds had elapsed since the other door had opened, but it had seemed much longer as Kuri's mind easily switched to the mode of rapid consciousness which combat demanded. Many of the suits' higher autonomous functions were disabled, but its target acquisition routines were still operable, so she ordered the suit to lock on to the wolfhounds, not actually firing, but keeping a bead on each one. She knew that her suit would confer with its two partners, between them devising a moment-by-moment strategy and allocating targets to each other, but that process was largely invisible to the wearer. Where the hell was Valyova? Was it possible she could have moved from one end of the chamber to the other, in time to appear in the pack? Yes, probably. Motion in a suit, at least on a scale this compressed, could be so rapid that a person might seem to disappear from one point and appear hundreds of meters further away an eye-blink later. But the enemy suits, Kuri had seen, had definitely come through the other door, which would have necessitated Valyova leaving the chamber and making her way to the other end through normal ship corridors and access ways. Even in a suit, even with the route keyed in beforehand, Kuri doubted that anyone could do that so quickly, not without becoming liquid en route. But maybe Valyova had a shortcut, a clear shaft through which she could move much more rapidly. Shit! Kuri was being shot at. The wolfhounds were firing, lancing her with small-grade laser fire, emerging in twin beams from malignant, closely spaced eyes in the upper hemisphere of their ellipsoid shells. By now, their camelioflage had adapted to the floor metal, turning them into purple lozenges, which seemed to dance in and out of clarity. Her suit skin had shivered to an optically perfect mirror, deflecting most of the energy, but some of the initial blasts had done real damage to the suit integrity. She would lose points for that. She had been too busy cogitating on Valyova's vanishing act to pay attention to the attack. That diversion, of course, had almost certainly been Valyova's intention. She looked around, confirming what the suit readouts were telling her, which was that her compatriots had all survived. Flanking her, Sujik and Kjarval resembled androform blobs of mercury, but they were not hurt and were returning fire. Kuri set her escalation protocols to stay one offensive step ahead of the enemy, but not to obliterate them. Her suit sprouted low-yield lasers, popping up on both shoulders, pivoting on turrets. She watched the beams converge ahead of her, knifing forwards, each burst leaving a lilac contrail of ionized air. When hit, the shining flying purple wolfhounds tended to crash out of the sky, bouncing to the ground or just exploding in hot blossoms. It would have been unwise in the extreme to be out in the chamber without a suit. "You were slow," Sujik said, on the general's suit, even as the attack continued. "This was real, we'd be hosing you off the walls. How many times you seen close quarters action, Sujik?"
Kjarval, who until then had said next to nothing, cut in on them.
We've all seen action, Kuri.
Yeah? And did you ever get close enough to the enemy to hear them scream for mercy? What I mean is, fuck!
Kjarval had just taken a hit. Her suit spasmed momentarily, flicking through a series of incorrect camelioflage modes. Space black, snow white, and then florid tropical foliage, making it look as if Kjarval were a door leading out of the chamber into the heart of some remote planetary jungle. Her suit stammered, and then regained its reflective sheen.
I'm worried about those other suits. That's what they're for, to make you worry and louse up.
We need help to louse up. That's a new one.
Shut it, Kuri. Just concentrate on the damned war.
She did. That part was easy. Roughly a third of the attacking wolfhounds had been shot down, and no new forces were emerging through the chamber's still-open end door. But the other suits—there were three of them, Kuri saw—had done nothing so far except loiter near the hole, and were now slowly moving towards the floor, correcting their descent with bursts of needle-thin thrust from their heels. As they did so, they too assumed a color and texture which matched the shot-up floor. It was impossible to tell which, if any, were occupied.
This is part of the scenario. Those suits. They've got to mean something.
I said shut it, Kuri.
But she continued.
We're on a mission, right? We have to assume that much. We have to impose some structure on the damned thing, or we don't know who the hell's the enemy.
Good idea, Sujik said. Let's schedule a meeting.
By now, the wolfhounds and their fire-returning suits were using particle beams. Maybe the lasers had been real. It was just within the bounds of possibility. But it seemed certain that any significantly more powerful weapon would be only simulated. After all, it would not be an auspicious end to the exercise if one of them blasted a hole in the chamber wall and vented all the air into space.
Let's assume, Kuri said, that we know who the hell we are and why we're here. Wherever here happens to be. The next question is, do we know those bastards in the other three suits?
This is getting way too philosophical for me, Kjarval said, loping away to draw fire.
If we're having this conversation, Kuri said, doggedly talking over Sudjuk's interjections, then we have to assume we don't know who they are, that they're hostile, and that means we should shoot the scum first, before they do whatever they're going to do to us.
I think you could be fucking up big time, Kuri.
Yeah, well, as you kindly pointed out, I'm the one who isn't going down anyway.
Amen to that.
People. This was Kjarval, who had noticed what it took Kuri and Sujik another moment to absorb. I don't like the look of that.
What she had seen was that the wrists of the three other suits were morphing, each extruding an as yet unformed weapon. The process was unnervingly rapid, like watching a party balloon inflate into the shape of an animal.
Shoot the fuckers, Kuri said, with a voice so calm it almost scared her. Full fire convergence on the leftmost suit. Go to minimum yield AC-AM pulse mode. Conic dispersal with lateral cross-sweep.
Since when are you giving... Just fucking do it, Sujik!
But she was already firing. Kjarval, too. The three of them were now standing apart by 10 meters, directing their suits' fire towards the enemy. The accelerated antimatter pulses were simulated, of course. If they had been real, there would have been little of the chamber left to stand on. There was a flash, one so bright that Kuri felt it reach out and push taloned fingers into her eyes. It felt too intense to have been properly simulated, too concussive. The noise of the blast hit with a force that seemed almost gentle by comparison, but the shock was still enough to throw her backwards, keeling into the mottled chamber wall. The bump was like bouncing onto a mattress in an expensive hotel room. For a moment her suit was out cold. Even when her eyes began to clear, she could see that the readouts had either died or turned to unreadably cryptic mush. They lingered in that state for a few agonizing seconds, before the suit's backup brain staggered online, reinstating what it could. A simpler, but at least comprehensible display returned to life, detailing what remained and what had been destroyed. Most of the major weapons were out. Suit autonomy was down by 50%, the persona slipping towards machine autism. There was extensive loss of servo assistance in 3 articulation points. Flight capability was impaired,
at least until the repair protocols could get to work, and they needed a minimum 2 hours to finesse a bypass solution. Oh, and, according to the biomedical readout, she was now minus one upper limb, from the elbow down. She struggled to a sitting position, and, though every instinct told her to spend the time getting safe and assessing the surroundings, she had to look at the shot-away limb. Her right arm ended just where the med readout said it would, truncating in a crumpled mass of scorched bone, flesh, and intermingled metal. Further up the stump, the gel air would have shock-congealed to prevent pressure and blood loss, but that was a detail she had to take for granted. There was no pain, of course, another aspect in which the simulation was utterly realistic, since the suit would be telling her pain center to shut down for the time being. Assess. Assess. She had lost her orientation completely in the blast. She looked around, but the suit's head articulation was jammed. There was suddenly an awful lot of smoke out there, hanging in coils in the air, venting from the chamber itself. The intermittent illumination provided by the aerial drones was now only a stuttering strobe effect. There were the wrecks of 2 suits over there, suffering the kind of comprehensive damage which might indicate that they had been hit by combined ACAM pulses. But the suits were too mangled for her to tell if they had, or had ever had, occupants. A 3rd suit, less critically damaged, and perhaps only stunned, as her own had been, rested 10 or 15 meters away around the great curve of the chamber's scarred wall. The wolfhounds were gone or destroyed. It was impossible to tell which.
Sudyk? Kjarval?
Silence. Not even her own voice properly audible, and certainly nothing resembling a reply. Intersuit comms were compromised, she saw now, a detail on the damage readout she had ignored until then. Bad, Kuri. Very bad. Now she had no idea who the enemy was. The ruined suit arm was fixing itself by the second, scorched parts sloughing to the ground, while the exterior skin crawled forwards to envelop the stump. It was faintly disgusting to watch, even though Kuri had seen it happen many times before, in other simulation scenarios on the edge. What was really nauseating was knowing that no such immediate repair was possible for her own wounds, that they would have to wait until she was medevaced out of the zone. The other suit, the one less damaged, was moving now, raising itself to a standing position just as she was doing. The other suit had a full complement of limbs, and many of its weapons were still deployed, jutting from various apertures. They were locking on to Kuri, like a dozen vipers poising for the strike. "Who's that?" she asked, before remembering that the comms were offline, probably for good. Out of the corner of her eye she saw another 2 suits off to one side, emerging from banners of languid, charcoal-dark smoke. Who were they? Remnants of the original 3 which had come down with the wolfhounds, or her comrades? The single suit with the weapons was approaching her very slowly, as if she were a bomb which might go off at any moment. The suit stopped, motionless. Its skin was trying to mimic the combination of the background color of the chamber wall and the smoke screens, with only moderate success. Kuri wondered how her own suit was doing. Was her faceplate opaque or transparent? It was impossible to tell from inside, and the minimalist readout told her nothing. If the one with the weapons saw a human face within, would that incite it to kill or hold fire? Kuri had locked her own usable weapons on the figure, but nothing she had seen told her whether she was pointed at the enemy or a mute comrade. She moved to raise her good arm, to indicate her face, asking the other to make its faceplate transparent. The other fired. Kuri was blown back into the wall, an invisible pile driver ramming into her stomach. Her suit started screaming, all manner of gibberish scrolling across her vision. There was a roar of sound before she hit the wall, the compressed burst of a frantic return fire from her own available weapons. Fuck, Kuri thought. That actually hurt at the visceral level, which somehow betrayed it as not having been simulated. She struggled to her feet again, just as another charge from the attacker slammed past and the 3rd caught her on the thigh. She started wheeling back, both arms flailing at the periphery of vision. There was something wrong with her arms, or, more accurately, something not wrong where something should have been. They were completely intact,
no sign that one of them had just been blasted off.
Shit, she said. What the fuck is happening?
The attack was continuing, each blast impacting her and driving her back.
This is Volyova, said a voice, not in any way calm and detached. Listen to me carefully, all of you. Something is going wrong with the scenario. I want you all to stop firing.
Curry had hit the deck again, this time with enough force that she felt it through the gel air cushion, like a slap against her spine. Her thigh felt injured, and the suit was doing nothing to ameliorate the discomfort. It's gone live, she thought. The weapons were for real now, or at least those which belonged to the suit attacking her.
Kyarval, Volyova said. Kyarval, you have to stop firing. You're killing Curry.
But Kyarval, Curry guessed that she was the attacker, was not listening, or not capable of listening, or, more terrifyingly, not capable of stopping.
Kyarval, the triumvir said again, if you don't stop, I'm going to have to disarm you.
But Kyarval did not stop. She kept on firing. Curry, feeling each impact like a lash, writhing under the assault, desperate to claw her way through the tortured alloy of the chamber into the sanctuary beyond. And then Volyova descended from the chamber's middle, where she had apparently been all along, unseen. As she descended, she opened fire on Kyarval, at first with the lightest weapon she had, but with steadily mounting force. Kyarval countered by directing some portion of her fire upwards towards the lowering triumvir. The blasts hit Volyova, gouging black scars into her armor, chipping fragments from the flexible integument, slicing off weapons as her suit tried to extrude and deploy them. But Volyova maintained an edge on the trainee. Kyarval's suit began to wilt, losing integrity. Its weapons went haywire, missing their targets, and then shooting haphazardly around the chamber. Eventually, it could not have been more than a minute after she had first started firing on Curry, Kyarval dropped to the ground. Her suit, where it was not blackened by the hits it had sustained, was a quilt of mismatched psychedelic colors and rapidly morphing hypergeometric textures, sprouting half-realized weapons and devices. Her limbs were thrashing crazily. The ends of the limbs had gone berserk, extruding and then budding off, various manipulators and rough, baby-sized approximations of human hands. Curry got to her feet, stifling a scream of pain as her thigh protested against the movement. Her suit was a stiffening dead weight around her, but somehow she managed to walk, or at least totter, to the place where Kyarval lay. Volyova and another suited figure, she had to be Sudyuk, were already there, leaning over what remained of the suit, trying to make some sense of its medical diagnostic readouts.
She's dead, Volyova said.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.